This episode is sponsored by Angry Robot Books. Angry Robot is an award-winning publisher of science fiction and fantasy novels. Based in London, it's grown into a global name and has, over the years, published award-winning titles such as Lauren Buick's Zoo City. For lovers of fantasy and sci-fi books, Angry Robot is at the forefront of the genres, publishing stories that speak to the issues of our time and take us on wild adventures with memorable characters. Be sure to check out some brilliant new titles in 2023, such as Ledge by Stacey McEwen and The Infinite, the latest book by Ada Hoffman, and The Judas Blossom by today's special guest, Stephen Aryan. If you're a writer looking for a home for your book, Angry Robot could be for you. As we'll hear in today's episode, authors have spoken of how much they enjoy the more freeing approach adopted by the AR team. At the moment, Angry Robot just accepts submissions from writers represented by an agent. However, do keep an eye out on social media for their open door submission periods. If you'd like to learn more about everything just mentioned, you can find a link in the description. Welcome to another episode of the Fantasy Writers Toolshed. I'm your host, Richie Billing, and today I'm thrilled to be joined by best-selling fantasy author Stephen Aryan, who's kindly given up time out of his very busy schedule to chat about his upcoming book, The Judas Blossom, and the writing process as a whole. Again, it's another fascinating discussion with an author at the very top of their game. I'm pretty sure you're going to learn something new and helpful, if not about writing, then about the publishing industry and working with agents and editors. Before we get to that, just a fast reminder that if you haven't already done so, to subscribe or follow the show on Spotify, iTunes, or whatever you listen to us on. I've also relaunched our YouTube channel, and there you can find episodes, playlists, and much more. If you really like what we do, I'd be ever so grateful if you left a quick rating on Spotify mobile app or whatever you stream the show through. In short, it tells us that we're doing something right and also helps other people find the show too. Speaking of which, one of the best ways that you can help us spread the word is to share the episode on social media or with anyone you think may be interested. The more listeners we get, the more episodes we can make. That's basically how it goes in the podcasting world. So if you like us and you want us to do more, then a few quick shares, that's all it takes. If you'd like to get involved beyond just listening to me ramble on with our fantastic guests, do head over to our Patreon page. There you can gain access to our writing group and community, fantasy writing classes, and interviews and blog posts and much, much more. The links for everything I've just mentioned can be found in the description. Now it's time to introduce today's guest, the brilliant author, Stephen Aryan. I'm delighted to be joined by the brilliant fantasy author, Stephen Aryan. Stephen, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you getting on?
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. Yeah, getting on well. Busy, busy. Lots to do, as usual.
Yeah, brand new year. You've got loads coming up. You've got a new novel on the horizon.
Yes. Oh, yeah. New trilogy kicks off this July, 11th of July, from Angry Robot Books. And I'm busy working on books one and two and three in different forms in some way, in different stages. So
nice.
We can talk about some of that if you want.
Definitely. Sounds like you're juggling a few balls there.
Yeah, it's usually the way. So even with a book coming out one a year, there's always something in different stages. So The Judas Blossom comes out in July. Yeah. The first draft is obviously done, and I've done my first major edit on that. I've handed in the first draft of book two at Christmas. And here we are in January 2023, and I'm just starting to write book three in the trilogy. Nice. But that will come out in 2025, so one a year for the next sort of 3 years, you know. But I'm already working on book three now.
Yeah.
So.
Sounds like you've been furiously drafting there, then.
Well, I my deadline's Christmas this 2023 for book three, so I've got time to do it, but
yeah,
you know, got to fit it in around everything else, like, you know, having a life and family and commitments and a job and all that kind of thing. So
yeah,
even though it's a long way off, it still keeps me busy.
Definitely. Yeah, I've been reading about The Judas Blossom, and it does sound fantastic. I really love your world building anyway, and this sort of Persian inspired world. Ah, it sounds fantastic. I think that's a good place to start. Can you tell us a bit more about it?
Yeah, so I always want to do something different with every new series. I never want to repeat myself. And with this one, it was something I'd been thinking about for a while, of doing historical fiction, but it's obviously it's inspired by, because it's got fantasy elements in. It's not pure historical fiction. So historians will have a hissy fit, but that's fine because it's not supposed to be for them.
Yeah.
So I just thought the book starts in the year 1260, so the 13th century, and it's not a part of the world that I've seen much fantasy about. It's not an era that I've seen much fantasy about, and I haven't seen any Persian-inspired fantasy. Okay. And I'd done a bunch of research, I'd done a bunch of reading, I'd watched like TV shows and other things that I thought, that's quite interesting. Like, you know, this Marco Polo is on Netflix. That was a series that ran, I think it was 2 years or something, and a special. Yeah. And that was very much about him in the Mongol courts of Kublai Khan. And this is, my story set in a similar era to that, but not in the same place. So Genghis Khan was the kind of the granddad of them all, and what he wanted to cover the world in one empire, you know, make the whole world the Mongol Empire. And as the years went on, he took over more and more land, then he died. And in the time of my story, the Mongol Empire split into four, they call them Khanates, four kind of territories, and each one is ruled by a different relative of Genghis Khan. And this is all fact so far. This isn't fiction. This is true.
Yeah.
So the story that I'm focused on is set in Persia, and that Khanate covers parts of Iran, Iraq, a bit of Syria, a bit of Afghanistan, and kind of all those countries around there from today's kind of borders. And this area is called the Ilkhanate, and it was ruled by one of Genghis Khan's grandsons for many years. And there's lots of fighting, expanding the borders, going east, going west, and they're all lots of kind of infighting. And it's a really complex part of history. There's loads of stuff going on. But the problem is, years of time will go by and there'll be no huge changes. Things are happening, but it's not massively relevant for like a story. You'd have to be like, oh, now we skip 8 months and then this happens and now we skip 9 months. And so you can't do that in world of, you know, in a fantasy story, because people want to know what's going on. So I've moved things around. I've got characters that are based upon real people. I've got fictional characters that are mixed in with there. I've got a bit of magic that I'm bringing in that's based upon stuff, but it's all set within Persia then, as it was called, and it's now modern day Iran. And so it's about the Mongols that were occupying Persia and all the other territories, and it's about a rebellion trying to get them out. Basically, they fought a war against the Mongol invaders and they lost. The army was defeated, and that's kind of like, right, well, now what? And the people are like, well, we still don't want them here. So it's about mounting a rebellion, trying to get them out in different means instead of just a head-on conflict, because they don't have the army anymore. And so I've got some facts, some fiction, and I move bits and pieces around of history. And I've got a stack of books you can't see, but behind this stack of my to read pile, there's some books there too.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to do the Dan Brown thing of like, I've read 800 pages of history. Now you're going to have to sit through all of it. So I've ignored certain things. I've shaved things off. I've moved things around to make it easy to get into, because I don't want someone stumbling over too many weird terms that they're not familiar with and constantly having to flick to a glossary.
Yeah.
Like if I have to keep doing that on the book and you've pulled me out the story, I'm done. So I'm conscious of all of this kind of stuff and trying to make it at the same time interesting and not just, here's a history book, you know?
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. I mean, I love historical fiction, and one of the reasons why is because I feel like I'm learning something new while following these brilliant characters.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you've taken that to the next level.
I mean, like people like Conan Golden does brilliant books about the Mongols, but his are much closer to kind of historical, you know, fact, you know, as much as his can be. But mine is definitely fantasy inspired, because there's stuff in there that obviously I've completely made up, and characters are completely made up. And then there's magic and other weird things in there creeping around. So it's telling a cohesive story by mixing these two things together. And it's the most challenging series I've ever done.
That's how you grow, though, by pushing yourself and seeing what you... Yeah, so it's brilliant. And but it sounds like you had to do an awful lot of research then. So how much time did you devote to that process?
Oh, I just did it gradually. I always do it like in parallel to other things. So at the moment, I'm doing bits and pieces of notes for the next project, like now. Yeah. I'm not even going to start writing that for 12 months, but I'm doing stuff in the background. So I'm like picking up bits and pieces, making notes. And I was doing the same then. I was reading some books and flicking through things and making notes. So I've probably been technically researching it for 2 years, but that's not like, you know, every day sitting down and writing. It's just bits and pieces.
Amazing. So in the midst of editing at the moment, so we never really talk about editing that much on the show. And I think I mentioned to you just before we started that it's a bit of a crime because it's arguably the most important part. So what is your editing process like? Have you got any tips or insights that you can share with us?
So there's the standard process that you go through with a publisher, and do you know about the different phases of that on the editing process?
Yeah, so we've had Laura Bennett on the show a few episodes ago, who's a literary agent, and she sort of explains how if you go through the agent process, then she's going to edit it, then it goes to an editor, a publisher, who's probably going to edit it again, and then there's more rounds of editors. It seems to be like an endless wave waves of editing.
Usually three or four. So when you first get a literary agent, some of them will edit the book with you. Some of them will just give you pointers. My agent, when I first started out, she did. I spent a year working on my book with my agent, Juliet. I revised it, you know, sent it back to her. She gave me some more notes. And over a year, I revised it. And then when that was done, we then submitted to a publisher, in this case, Orbit, for my first series. They took on the trilogy. Then you do different stages of edits with the publisher, and those are kind of fixed. There's certain ones that you know you will do. So there'll be the first major edit where your editor will give you quite a detailed breakdown of, you know, here's the things that I think need attention, like bullet points, and then a more detailed letter breaking down in more information about specifics of what you should look at, themes, ideas, characters, whatever it might be. Once you've done that, it'll then go to like a copy editor, who's someone who hasn't read the book before, who's usually an external person to the publisher, and they will go through and do their kind of thing. Not quite as detailed, but like sense checking, structure, some punctuation and, you know, grammar and that kind of thing. Dates, times, things that can move around sometimes, consistency, all that kind of thing. And then I then edit based upon that. Then you'll do a proofread, which is just they send you the book of how it'll look when it comes out as a physical book, you know, with your name at the top and page numbers. And at that point, it's just punctuation and grammar. You can't move stuff around at that point. And usually at the proof is when you get advanced reading copies. So when it goes out, it'll say to someone, this is an uncorrected proof. It means I haven't done my proof yet and I corrected it. And the publisher hasn't done their version of it yet. But that's why people get ARCs ahead of time. But my own personal process is, so once I've done the first draft, I leave it for a while, as long as I can, normally, at least a couple of weeks, and let it just kind of sit. Because with working on a book for so long, you can't see the wood for the trees. You're kind of so close to it. And you don't always understand the shape of the book until you get to the end of it. Because those first few chapters, you could have written a year ago, 2 years ago, even, depending on how fast you wrote a draft. And when you look back, you can sometimes see some of the mistakes you were already made, or you got to the end and you think, actually, that isn't quite what the character should have been for where they ended up. And so it's a case of you have to step back from the book and say, right, is the character arcs, are they what I want them to be? Where they started, where they end up? Is it consistent? Does it make sense? Now that you can see the whole through line throughout the whole book, do a world building pass across the book. Like, is it too much? Is it not enough? Does this make sense? Go through and do that. I'll do a dialogue pass as well. My dialogue is typically fairly easy to read. It's never massively long or complicated. I don't want too many atypical words that people can't read. I'm very much of the Stephen King variety of why use a $5 word when a 20-cent word will do when people understand what it means?
Exactly. I think with dialogue especially, like, people aren't using these crazy words in dialogue. They're just trying to get the message across as quickly and easily as possible. in most common languages anyway.
This is it. So I do various revisions like that. And once I've done things like that, also crutch words. When I do a draft, certain words that you don't really need.
Yeah.
Just going through and find all the crutch words, like very big, very this. So go find the verys, take them all out.
Yeah.
Something, a lot.
Yeah.
Or despite. Certain just words that you find you keep using, go through and just like cut them out. And I'm not someone who says, oh, you can't have any adjectives. No, you shouldn't do that. I think you can, but there are certain words that I find myself repeating. I don't realize I'm doing it. On the first draft, you're just getting it out.
Yeah.
You know, and I go through and do like a crutch word sweep and cut out like 500 words just from doing that.
Yeah. I've noticed where I've been rereading Battle Mage, and I've noticed that with your descriptions, you are very sort of, you keep it to what you need.
Yeah.
And I noticed that you do this thing as well. I think I was reading a psychology book, and it was one of the best ways to convey an image to someone is to use two adjectives next to each other. So, for example, the deep blue coat is more, it creates a clearer picture in someone's mind than a blue coat. Just simple things like that, and knowing how to use the adjectives, I suppose, is so important.
Yeah, you just don't want to go overboard, but you also don't want to give so much information that you don't leave any room for the imagination in the mind of the reader. I'd much rather give them a charcoal sketch of a person and they fill in the gaps of the character in their own mind on the page, because I'm not supplying a picture.
Yeah.
You know, where people are saying, oh, who's your guest cast, you know, if it was made for TV or film. And I don't really have anyone typically, because as soon as you tie it down, that's what people see in their heads. So now forever, Iron Man is always Robert Downey Jr. Always. In every comic, someone sees it and they'll be like, does it look like Robert Downey? It's like, well, you know, so it's that kind of a thing. You always, so with books, until it gets made or it never gets made, you just give them the basics and they fill in the rest. And I think that works fine.
Yeah, I totally agree. And everyone's version of that character is different. And I think that's what makes it, you engage with it on a much greater level, don't you?
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
So that's quite a really thorough editing process, and it sounds like you prioritize things. So you're looking at the characters, well-built, and I always think following them character arcs is so important, and making sure that the sort of peaks and troughs of that character's journey is just, it makes sense. It's sort of, sometimes you read fantasy books and this character may have just like killed someone, and there's just like no reflection on the fact that she's done that, and they're not sort of presented in sort of some sort of callous, heartless person, but there's just no sort of character developments like related to the sort of conflict within the story. But
it's consistency, I think. You have to have characters that are consistent, that when you read everything that's happened to them, it makes sense to you as a reader, so that when someone else picks it up and reads it, they follow through this person's journey, they see all of their peaks and troughs, and they understand, like, you know, they killed a whole bunch of people, and then they kind of spend a lot of time reflecting about it and wondering how it's changed them. That's perfectly normal and reasonable, as opposed to kill a bunch of people, I'm fine, everything's okay, and they just carry on thinking, well, that's not realistic then, is it? It has to be consistent of, if this was a real person, how would it affect them mentally? So
I can't wait to get into characters in a little bit, but I thought it would be, well, it makes sense anyway for our listeners. If we dive back to the very beginning and looked at your writing process from like the ideas stage, because you do strike me as a person who's always coming up with brilliant ideas and you're always finding unique angles for things. So where do you find your inspiration for all these stories?
It's a case of everything and everywhere, like every TV show, every book, every comic, everything I see, every conversation, it all kind of filters into your brain. I read a ton of fantasy, and I don't think that directly influences me, but I think good books are fuel that make me want to go and write as well. Like if I read a bunch of really bad books or books that I'm struggling with, I then struggle to write. So yeah. I think your brain is a muscle in that the more often you write, the easier it is. But equally, I think you have to kind of feed it and give it lots of content. And the more stuff you give it, that's and with the variety as well. Because if you just read one kind of thing all of the time, I think it can limit the ideas that are generated.
Yeah.
So everywhere is the kind of the obvious and easiest answer, I think, unfortunately, for where I get my ideas from.
No, it makes sense though. You've got to completely open your mind and just be a big sponge, haven't you? Just absorb everything. And you never know what comes out when you're writing. Like the most random things might just pop into your head, and that could be the missing piece of the puzzle.
Yes, because I plan my books to a degree, but not everything. Yeah. And some of the best ideas come from those creative leaps where you don't know how you get between two points. Sometimes they end up getting cut because they don't work the rest of the book. And sometimes those are the best things you can develop on into weird and different ideas that you hadn't planned and hadn't anticipated. But in the moment when you're writing it, it made sense. And when you come back and look at it, you're like, oh, yeah, of course, that should be there. And we need to develop it this way. And off you go. So,
yeah. That was something I was going to ask you about next, actually, is how you approach a sort of writing project. So you've mentioned you're a bit of a loose approach?
So I do plan all my books. I've tried it the other way. I wrote a whole novel without planning it much before, and it was an absolute disaster, and I never showed it to anybody, and it never went anywhere because it didn't make sense. And to make it make sense, I'd have to basically rip it apart and start it over. So I was like, yeah, I've learned that's not my process. My process is I plan, once I've got a rough idea of where the story's going in my head rattling around and who the characters are and everything, then I commit it to paper or, you know, on a file, on a Word document. I always know the end, beginning, the middle, the end. I always know a bunch of various milestones along the way. I don't have every single chapter broken down, but I know what's going on and the flow of the story.
Yeah.
And once I've got that, I then do a slightly more detailed version of the main arcs, who the characters are, what their developments are. And when I start writing, I'll kind of front load the first 10 chapters, put a bit more information down, and then work my way through them. And based upon that, I can see how the next bit of the story will change, even within the frame that I've set, and it flexes and moves. Then I'll write that chunk, and then I'll do it that way. So I'm constantly adjusting it, but the whole plan is roughly set. But so the story never veers too far on what my original plan was, but there's flex within it. Yeah. And I don't always know the breakdown of every chapter, like I said, and I get creative leaps of things that in the moment that just come when you're typing, when you're in the zone. It's worked for me so far. So the process works for me. Do it. If it's like a friend of mine, RJ Barker, doesn't do nearly as much planning, but that works for him. That process works for him because he needs to have that kind of creative stuff when he's doing it, and he doesn't go into massive detail. Great, it works for him too. He's doing very, very well. So,
yeah,
finding your own method.
That's it, isn't it? It is exactly that, finding your own method. We had Adrian Tchaikovsky on the show, and he said exactly the same thing. It's just finding your own way. And he's a very organized person, and he likes that sort of rigorous planned approach. But like, I think I've tried doing it different ways, and I think I've settled in a sort of hybrid approach where, just like what you said, you've got a sort of an idea of where you want the story to go, what you want to happen. But I do think I think what you've just said there about the first 10 chapters, like, I think you need to plan it a little bit more in that period, because you're still getting to know your characters.
Yeah.
And once they come to life, I've getting towards the end of like a novel, for example, that character is alive in your mind, and God knows what's going to happen.
You've been living with them for months in your head, you know, working on them every day or every week. And so you get to know them really, really well by the end of the book, which is why when you go back to the beginning, sometimes you're like, that's not quite right now that I know what their journey is.
Yeah. So, I don't know if you've ever found this, when you finish the novel, like, what is your emotional sort of reaction to ending that project? Are you quite obviously satisfied and happy that you finished? But for me personally, when I finished a novel, I was quite sad that I was letting go of these characters. Because, like you say, we were with them for years, for like every day, and then all of a sudden they're not there. And it feels a little bit empty. Weird.
It's a bit of relief, because it can be quite intense if you're going through all the emotions that your characters do and you're trying to make them feel realistic in the story. You share a portion of that, or I do when I'm working on them.
I've
only ever written trilogies so far, and the idea of doing something longer at the moment for me seems like a real stretch, because I also have lots of other ideas and I kind of want to get onto something else. So spending more than 3 years on the same story effectively seems like a bigger stretch. And I admire those who've got really long running series, but I don't think it's for me at the moment. I think I want to get on and do something else. So usually when I finish a book, I'm happy that it's done, because then I can go back and start working on it. When I finish a series, it's a little bit scary because the next thing is jumping into the abyss and it's completely brand new. But also it's exciting because I'm not tied down by anything that I've already established. So I did that first trilogy, Age of Darkness, and then did a second trilogy set within the same world, The Age of Dread, which is good because a whole bunch of stuff set up. I don't need to reintroduce it. But equally, I've also kind of handcuffed myself in certain things. Like, oh, I can introduce this. No, you can't because it doesn't exist in this world. Oh, yeah, can't do that.
Yeah.
So it's good and bad starting a new series. It's always different.
How did you find approaching this one?
Massive challenge, as I said, because it's so complicated. There's so much going on. I'm trying to be honest with big events that happen within that period of history, but at the same time, bring something new, and weaving those two things together, fact and fiction, and adding my own kind of style to it. Massively challenging. I mean, I always want to do something different. I always want to challenge myself, but this was probably more difficult than I thought it was going to be honest.
Next
series, something a little easier, that's for sure. Definitely.
I suppose like with historical fiction, it's the same is true with fantasy to a certain extent, but you can always get away with it by like sort of bending details. So like, oh, a sword that's probably a bit too big to carry for a normal person, you know, like them kind of things. You can get away with it because it's fantasy. With historical fiction, I'm sure you're a bit more tied to truth, aren't you?
A little bit, yeah. There's still fantastic elements in it. Like, there's no non-human races running around or anything like that. It's still set within our world. There's just, you know, I'm suggesting a bunch of things happened that may not have happened, and a bunch of things went on that people really didn't know about back then. But yes, it's a little bit more restrictive. So my next series, I think, is going to have a lot more fantasy elements in it after this. I think that's the plan so far anyway.
Yeah, that's nice to have a bit of a break from writing fantasy. I mean, do you always write fantasy, or do you like to experiment like with this kind of genre, like historical fiction? Do you like other types of fiction as well?
I have written other kinds of stories before, and other kinds of novels before. I've done like a horror novel. I did like a Lovecraftian modern day Stephen King kind of novel about these kind of weird things, weird monsters coming back that have been around, buried for, you know, centuries, and they're kind of waking up and stuff. Did a crime novel, fast-paced, seat-your-pants kind of Dean Koontz-style thriller novel. And these are kind of on my journey to getting published. I did a bunch of other fantasy novels that went nowhere. And I kept coming back to fantasy because it was my first love and I enjoyed writing it so much. And I've kind of got to the point where technically I can write any genre of novel and it can still be fantasy.
Yeah.
So my first trilogy, they're all labeled as fantasy, but they're all separate genres in a way. So the first book is very much, Battle Mage was very much a war novel, all about, in essence, what is a First World War. The second novel essentially has police officers investigating a serial killer. There are warring crime families, a bit of like Sopranos and stuff. There's magic and someone trying to hunt down someone. There's espionage in that book, and it's all set within one city.
Yeah.
And then the third book, Chaos Mage, is basically a post-apocalyptic horror novel set in a city on the edge of the world where no one wants to go because it seems to be haunted by something. And there are things that come out at night that kill people.
Yeah. You know,
but it's all fantasy. But I've all basically done very different genres within it. So now I'm doing historical fantasy. So it's different again. it's just, there are so many subgenres now that exist in fantasy that people have labels for, you know, grim dark or low mad fantasy or whatever it might be. And that's fine. They're helpful for when people are going to buy books. For me, I kind of write the story and then someone else will tell me what subgenre technically it is. I'm more interested in the kind of story. But when it goes to my editor, it's fantasy. And then they tell me what it is.
The marketing people source all the details.
They can do that bit.
So you mentioned that it sounds like you have written quite a lot of novels, like you say, on your journey to get them published. What was it like, that journey? Was it frustrating at any time that you weren't getting to the place that you wanted to be, or did you just not care because you were just doing something that you loved?
Oh no, it's massively frustrating. So it took me over a decade to get an agent. And then a publisher. I was writing novels, sending them out, getting rejected by all of the agencies, having a break, starting the next novel, and doing that over and over again. So I did that for like over 10 years before I got anywhere. I'd go to all the conventions, I'd listen to all the panels, try and glean as much information as I could. It's extremely frustrating, especially when you didn't get any feedback, because I was doing it before there was the level of feedback you can get now from agents, editors, working with people online who can edit your work for you and give you pointers and structural stuff. It was so frustrating because the worst part was not knowing why you rejected, because you'd just get a standard reply, no information saying we don't like this or this doesn't work or you need to work on that. So not knowing is the worst. If someone says, I don't like it for these reasons, or it's not good enough for these reasons, that's fine. One agent can say, I don't like it. The next agent say, I love it, because it comes down to personal taste. But if both agents had said, it's too slow, and the next one says, yeah, it's too slow, clearly you need to know, you need to work on your pace. But not knowing any of that, how can you possibly get better? And all I could do was keep writing and trying to get better through the process of just writing a new novel and another one, hence why I tried different genres, different styles. I read different genres to kind of work on my own voice and eventually went back to what I loved, fantasy, put a bunch of our cool ideas that I thought would be interesting in, and then that led to Battle Mage. So,
it's a brilliant journey, and I just love the perseverance as well.
I wrote a massively long blog post on my website that details like the kind of the fullness of the story. And I did screenplays, I've done comics, I entered competitions, I've done all sorts of things over the years on my way to getting there.
Sounds like you had the determination to get what you wanted, like, and fair play to you for doing
it. I just wasn't ready to quit. Other people quit, I just kept going. I wasn't going to stop. I mean, I still enjoy writing novels now. Some people say they enjoy having written. I'm very much of the case that I love writing books. When I'm doing it, I love doing it. I love part of the process. The editing is tough, and it's probably my least favorite part, but actually writing books, it's brilliant. Love doing it.
Well, I'm happy that you've got the chance to to do it now, and you're treating us all to a fantastic story, so thanks very much.
Yes.
If we just go back to your characters, because some of my favorite characters, like Balfour and Vargas, yeah, they feel alive. So how do you create such vivid characters?
Yeah, that's $1 million question. It comes back to thinking about characters that I like and I think feel real, and then trying to understand what it is about them in any genre, you know, TV, film, books, comics. What makes them feel real to you? What makes them feel rounded? What makes them feel alive? I'm not someone that say my characters speak to me. If they speak to you, I think you need to go and stop drinking so much or something. But I think you have to treat each character as a fully rounded person. And even if the reader never sees everything on the page, it has to be there in the back of your mind somewhere. I don't base any of my characters on particular people. I think that can cause problems. Like someone say, oh, did so-and-so inspire this character? The answer is always no, they didn't. Equally, it's the same with the acting thing of, is that this so-and-so looks like so-and-so? No, it's not that either. They're alive in my head, and how they act and how they respond. and a great exercise, writing exercise, is get two of your characters that don't get along and put them in a room and just write them talking to each other.
Yeah.
Just start free writing. And then you'll get to understand the two characters and who they are. So put two characters, you know, you would not get on if they met in real life. In your book, whatever it is, they may never, ever meet. Doesn't matter. Put them in a room and start writing about a conversation. Give them a topic and see what happens. And that's how you get to know them. Like, what are they saying about whatever it might be, whatever, you know, religion or politics or the new king or so-and-so, or is so-and-so a royalist and the other person hates them? Why is that? And then you start thinking about these things in the back of your brain all the time, you know, while you're at work, you're on the bus, when you're going for a run, when you're in the shower, start ticking things over like, so-and-so wouldn't like that. Yeah, yeah, but so-and-so would, right? Why is this person like that? They've had this happen to them. How's that affected their view of the world? And it's that thing of, you gradually build it up layer by layer. No characters for me pop onto the page fully formed. Some, I get a rough idea, and then when you start playing around with them, it kind of solidifies in my brain, and then it comes onto the page. It hopefully feels realistic. Some of that still comes through in the editing process. Sometimes you'll write it, and then when you go back to the beginning again, you go, yeah, that they wouldn't say that. Having now finished the story and seen what journey they go on, that isn't quite right, and you tweak it. So how I do it, I don't know, gradually, slowly, you know, over time, best answer I can give, really.
It's just like getting to know a person in real life, isn't it?
Yeah, this is it.
What about other aspects of your story then, like your conflict, plot, theme? Do you hold a lot of weight on them when you're planning out your projects?
I spend a lot of time on world building. There again, I'll be making notes for years in a file before I ever actually start writing the story. Themes, most of the time, I know what the theme is going in. Sometimes I don't. I know the story, and it's through the process of writing it that the theme becomes apparent.
Yeah.
Sometimes in the editing process, the editor is vital because they can stare at a manuscript in a way that you can't. They can step back and say, okay, I think the theme is this. Is that right? Yes. Okay, this bit doesn't work, and these are the reasons why. It doesn't align with everything that you've done. And you need someone else to help you with that clarity of vision sometimes. So I'll give you an example. In Battle Mage, it's all very much about, you know, the war and what's going on and all these sort of things. And there was a subplot about a serial killer. And whilst it was interesting, it didn't fit with everything else. She said, you know, it develops this character and this works, but it doesn't really work with everything else you've done. So we kind of culled that story thread. Character stayed, but they were doing other things. And it just made more sense. It tightened everything up.
Yeah.
So that's good. Sometimes I know exactly what the theme is, and sometimes it develops. It varies from book to book for me.
It's a tricky theme. Like, it's something I've always struggled with, and I've never been able to find anyone who's explained it well enough to me. Go on.
For every book, or most books, there's the story, and then there's what it's about.
Yeah, exactly. What sometimes, is the story is about?
Sometimes the what it's about doesn't come until you finish the book, and then you can look back. Or someone else reads it and says, oh, you were blatantly writing about this, and then you think about it and go, oh yeah, I was. Sometimes it's subconscious, and sometimes you know going in. So with The Coward, I knew exactly what the theme was right from the start. It's the core of the whole book. Everyone says, oh, it's a quest adventure story. Yes, it is. That's the story, but that's not what it's about at all. Yeah. You know, it says in the back of the book, it's a quest book. It's called the duology is called A Quest for Heroes. There's a clue. It's a quest book. Oh, no, they're both quest books, but that's not what it's about. The theme of the first one is very, very specific. And I had that front and center. The first line tells you everything about the theme as well of the book. And it carries all the way through.
That's a clever way to do
it. Not always, just say, The Coward does it. No, the others don't. The Coward is very obvious.
But every story is different, though, and some, depends what you're motivated to, what motivates you to write it. It could be like a message or a general theme that has really driven you to write that story, and you just put more weight on that particular part of the story.
Yeah. But
like a lot of our listeners in particular love world building, and that gets an awful lot of attention in stories. And your stories, the worlds are just like so vivid, and you feel like you're there walking with the characters. So you do put an awful lot of effort into it by the sounds of it, like planning for years and years. But how, when it comes to the actual writing, how do you achieve that sort of immersiveness?
It's the balance thing again. So all of my books are fairly lean compared to some authors, and that's partly by design, partly because of my own particular style. You'll never see a 700, 800 page book from me. It's just not what I do. If I had a book that long, it would be two books. It just wouldn't be that. And some people are quite happy to do that. For me, I'm very conscious of too much and it'll slow the story down. And some people say, oh, I want more of this and more of that. And I'm like, well, there's stuff there on the page that if you read it, it'll give you an idea and it'll show you what's going on. I don't want to give too much because I don't want people to be just wading through eight pages about the type of coins and the money system, and because that's boring for me to write. And I think if I'm bored writing it, it's going to be boring to read. Yeah. And while a handful of readers will probably love all about the coins and who's minted on it and what the person was, and he's the seventh king, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I'm already bored. Yeah. So, you know, pace isn't everything. But you need to have a balance between giving enough so the reader can see what's going on, but not too much that they just get bogged down and lose track of the story.
Yeah.
And it's tricky. I've done too much before. My editor, my agent have said, yeah, this kind of tails off, or there's just too much there. And sometimes they've said, we need a bit more information on this. So it varies, but my books are never huge on purpose.
Yeah. Less is more, as they say.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
I think I've the same sort of school of thought as you, in that you don't want to bore the arse off people, do you? You just want to give them enough. Mm. And if they do want to go off and learn more about it, then you can do some fancy appendix like they do for Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones or something like that, can't you?
Some of my favourite authors write huge books, but I don't think their world building is like so dense. So Robin Hobb, she's one of my favorite fantasy authors, and her books are all like 600-800 pages, but I never feel bogged down. I never feel like she's dragging her heels. I never skim anything she writes because it's all important, but it's not 20 pages of stuff and then the story moves on and then more pages of stuff. There's always events, there's always character developments, there's always change in all of her books. There's a lot going on throughout all of her books. I love that about hers. I can burn through, you know, an 800 page book from her in the same time as a 350 page book from someone else, because I want to know what's going on. I'm so excited about it. And so people love the huge books, but it's not something I'll write, but I will read some authors that do it that way because they do it well. It's not just tons of detail.
Yeah, definitely. Something I always like to ask people when they come on the show is, where do you still encounter challenges with your writing?
Oh, all the time. even now, all the time. It's not. Everyone say, no, it must get easier now. Nah, it doesn't. It doesn't. Because, as I said, I don't want to ever repeat myself. I always want to push myself. I always want to do something different. So writing the same kind of story over and over again just get boring and repetitive.
Yeah.
So the challenge is to do something different, to do something new, to find a new twist or a new story or a new way of doing something or updating something, whatever it might be. So that's a challenge.
Yeah.
Finding the time to write around everything else in my life, that's still an ongoing challenge. World building, I love doing it. So that's not a problem. It's just doing all of it together, I think. So I'm pretty good at deadlines. I set deadlines myself. And so I'll sort of say, you know, so many words per week, so many words per month, and then I've got a finished draft. So I'm always good at deadlines. That kind of helps drive me forward. But sometimes if I write too often, too regularly, I can burn myself out. So I have to be careful.
Yeah.
I took a complete break over Christmas. I had kind of 2 weeks off for Christmas. I did no writing at all, nothing. No notes, no world building, absolutely nothing, because I needed that time off to recharge.
Yeah.
And being a traditionally published author, I'm trying to, you know, build up a body of work. I've got 8 novels out at the moment. 9's coming out this year. 10 is drafted. I'm going to start writing 11. So you've got to constantly produce, you know, work. So it's balance of all of that, those things, yeah. I think. But, you know, I've written one, we'll start doing further edits on one. I'll start editing 2 this year, and I'm writing 3. At the same time, I'm thinking about, well, what's next? Because in a few months, my agent or my editor's going to ask me, so what's next?
Yeah.
So doing all of those things all at the same time, that's the challenge for me.
Yeah,
not actually sitting down to write. If I didn't have any other job and I can just sit and write, there's still going to be a challenge of doing that because you suddenly have less distractions. Like Brandon Sanderson, he writes full time. So clearly that guy's producing like 3 or 4 books or 5 books a year. He has probably so few distractions that when he sits down to write, he doesn't need to worry about, oh, do I need to go and take the washing out, the dryer? And oh, do I need to do the shopping list? Oh, I need to go and walk the dog.
Yeah.
He's probably got people who be like, go and write for 5 hours. Don't worry about anything. When you come back, we'll have sorted some stuff. Right. Or his wife or his kids or whatever. You're like, yep, we're dealing with it.
Yeah.
That's the kind of challenge.
Have to do yourself a Kickstarter there, Stephen.
I'm not big enough yet to do that, but I'd like to write full time eventually, just so that I could, focus more. You know,
and I mean, how far away do you think you are? Have you got a plan in place for where you'd want to be? You want to get to that stage?
No idea. It's a case of however many books do well enough that it generates enough income that I could write full time.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah,
I know you're very active on YouTube and. Is that something that you're looking to bring into your sort of writing business as a whole, like to use them different channels to promote what you're doing?
Yeah. I mean, social media can be good and bad. I'm on Twitter talking to other writers. I kind of use it as a pseudo water cooler to talk to the writers now and have a break for 20 minutes and
that's
chat
a great
to them
way to describe it.
Because I don't work in an office most of the time. I work at home.
Yeah.
And with writers, you always work at home. You never sat in a room together. So instead of now, it used to be the old days of go for a coffee, chat. Oh, did you watch so-and-so? Yeah, did you enjoy it? How was going on? Yeah, right. Then you go back to work. And now I kind of use Twitter in the same way to talk to other writers about that. I'm on Instagram, but I don't really understand it very well. I'm not that great with it. I'm on there a bit. YouTube allowed me to talk to other authors because after 2 years of lockdown, I wanted to talk to the writers that I do at conventions and have great conversations. They know everything that I'm going through because they've done it themselves. The same struggles, the same challenges, characters, world building, fitting it in or everything else. They all have the same thing.
Yeah.
So I started YouTube primarily because there's a lot of bad information out there about traditional publishing, and it really annoyed me.
Yeah.
I also missed talking to the writers, so giving an excuse to interview them. But basically, I'm just having a chat with them, like, how did they get started? What's their book about? What's going on? Let's talk about things. I do have a writing Discord called Headspace that spun out of my YouTube channel that's where bunch of writers come on and they're there and they post pieces of their work and they do critiques with each other. And so if someone doesn't have, you know, beta readers or they want feedback or, you know, the other writers are on the group there, help each other out, short stories, first few chapters, swap reads with each other. And I kind of dip in and out, tell them what's going on with the YouTube channel, tell them about my writing.
Yeah.
If I can give any feedback, I will, but a lot of time I don't have time, but I've made this kind of little hub where people are working on it there, and they're all supporting each other, which is really, really good.
It's amazing, isn't it, when things like that develop?
Yeah, yeah.
It's so satisfying.
It's nice, and I'm trying to foster good relations between writers so that there's to combat a lot of the bad information out there.
Yeah.
Especially about traditional publishing. There's so much negative stuff that's just not true. And there's quite a few videos on my channel about saying, well, that's not true. Let's debunk this myth, debunk that myth about it. Talk about some of the realities of being traditionally published as well.
Could you share some of them insights now? Because that was the conveniently my next question.
Some of the myths and stuff. Yeah, there's a lot of myths around the way the money works, that you have to like pay for edits and stuff, which is not true at all. If you're traditionally published, you never put your hand in your pocket. Money always flows from other people to you. You don't pay your agent until you've got a book deal, and they don't get paid until you do as well. Yeah. So I didn't give money from my pocket to my agent, to my editor, and all the rest of it. The deal is they're doing a bunch of work, so when I get paid, they get paid as well for their work, which sounds perfectly reasonable to me. The flip side of that is self-published, where you pay a bunch of people to do all the same jobs, but it comes out of your pocket and you're hiring them as part of your team.
Yeah.
If you want absolute control on all the different elements, you can go this down the self-publishing route. I'm happy to give the work to someone else to do, and I get that time back to do other things, like start working on the next book, because I don't have time as it is to fit everything else in anyway. Myths around money is one thing. I saw a great thing on Twitter. I don't know if you saw this. Someone said, if you had to cut 10,000 words from your novel and wait 2 years, would you go traditionally published or not? And some people were like, no, I'd never do that. That's ridiculous. I'm like, that's basically the reality of traditional publishing.
Yeah.
Someone said, if they want to cut 10,000 words, they better write it themselves. I'm like, you clearly don't understand how editing works or what it's for. And 2 years, it can be shorter, but 2 years sounds reasonable to me.
Yeah.
If you want it shorter, you can hire, as I said, I'm not saying self-publishing is evil and traditional publishing is amazing. Two very different routes, as I always talk about on the videos. That's another thing I talk about, the differences.
Yeah, it's definitely more business driven going down. It's like the corporate route, isn't it? And you've got to fit in with their publishing schedules and their timelines.
Yeah.
And that's the way it goes, isn't it? You've just got to surrender to...
Well, so every publisher will have a list of authors that they're currently working with. Like, you know, so I'm currently with Angry Robot Books. I'm working on my Nightingale and the Falcon trilogy starting this year. So they know, and I know, next 3 years, I've got a book coming out. At the same time, they'll be trying to get a whole bunch of new writers in, and they know that I've got a book coming out every July. So they don't want a book that's too similar to mine coming out in July for the next 3 years. So they'll be like, right, Stephen's book's coming out in July. Yours is similar-ish. We're going to put it in January. Therefore, we're not, you know, you're not cannibalizing anybody's sales or for anybody. That's just one author. But each publisher's got 30, 40, 50, 100 authors on the books in different stages.
Yeah.
So the delay thing is one, you know, that's one of the reasons why certain times of the year, you know, are better to release books than they know there. Again, they know this kind of thing. So you do have to fit in with their schedule, but it's all explained to you. None of it's kept secret. None of it's hidden.
Yeah.
That's another thing people think is a myth. They're like, they do all this stuff they don't tell you. If they don't tell you, you ask the question and then they'll tell you.
Yeah.
It's that simple.
It's a partnership, I think. Like, I've always understood that as a partnership, even between your agents and that partnership grows if you sell that book, don't you, between the editor from the publisher. So everyone wants the same goal.
Well, this is it. The difference is, traditional publishing, it's a separate company. Self-publishing, you are the owner and business runner of your entire enterprise. You get to decide everything and pay for everything and sort everything. So if you want to put a book out in 3 months, you can. You can do it, or less time even.
Yeah.
But you've got to do all of that. Whereas with a traditional publishing route, it's a larger entity, a larger company. Other people have to get paid.
Yeah.
And it just takes a bit longer. But I'm okay with that. I may self-publish something in the future as well, if I can, around everything else.
Yeah.
It's a partnership.
I saw you had a how-to book on writing, like a craft book.
Yeah, yeah. I've got an e-book out.
Was that something you published yourself?
Yeah, I did it a while ago. It's been out, I think, about 2 years. So it's just it's debunking a bunch of myths about writing. It's got a lot of writing advice in that I'd kind of collated from various things I'd been over the years. It's got my original covering letter, because people are always saying, how do you write a synopsis? How do you write a covering letter? How do you do that? So it's got my original covering letter that I wrote in for Battle Mage to Juliet, my agent. It's got her feedback on what she liked about it, her responses, and the back and forth. So you can see exactly what I wrote to her, why she liked it, what was good about it, what hooked her, and then her notes and then my notes on that. So that's like one bit of the book. And there's a bunch of other notes about debunking stuff, how the money works, what are the stages, what do you need to get published, what don't need to get published. Social media following, there's another big myth. Someone says, oh, you have to have 10,000 followers on this or agents won't talk to you.
Yeah.
Not true. Not true. All this kind of stuff. So yeah, that ebook is out on Amazon.
Yeah.
It's free on Kindle Unlimited. If you've got Kindle Unlimited, it's free. Otherwise, right. It's like, I don't know, $2.99 on Kindle.
Well worth it, all by the sounds of it. I'm going to get it just for the...
my covering letter.
Yeah. Because Juliet Mushins, she's a really talented and brilliant agent, isn't she? She's like a big name in the literary world. So
yeah.
You're very well represented. So it's amazing to see, like, the how of it, like, and...
Yeah, so I first contacted her in 2013. So this year is the 10th year I've been working with her. My debut came out in 2015. So yeah, 8 years ago.
I know. Busy. Well, last question I think is a nice one to finish on is what one piece of advice would you give to anyone thinking about writing a novel?
So if you're determined to write a novel, and you're not starting with a short story or a novella or something else, and you've never written a novel before, plan it to some degree. Even if you're like, oh, but I want to make it up by seat my pants and blah, blah, blah. Put some notes down and put some planning and some kind of structure in place, because writing a novel is always a marathon. It's never a sprint.
Yeah.
Because even if you do it fast one time, and it goes and it goes great, and you get an agent and you get a book deal. At a certain point, they're going to turn around and say, what's next? What are you working on next? So you've got to get used to that process, and it's a marathon. Yeah. The other thing is, if you've never written a book before, it's a huge commitment of time. So if you've got that structure in place and something happens, like, you know, we've had COVID, and there's been a lockdown, and jobs change and jobs move, and you have to move house, or, you know, something happens, and you can't write for a while, when you come back, if you haven't planned anything, trying to recapture that same brain space and move on from where you were before is incredibly difficult. Whereas if you've got a framework, you can be like, oh, that's where I was going next. I can see what I'm going to do. Okay. And then you can move forward. Whereas if you've got no plan at all, you'll never get there. You'll never progress. And the other danger is you won't feel like you're making progress. Was you've got this plan and you're like, oh, I'm up to about the halfway mark of my rough plan. Oh, I feel like I'm actually getting somewhere. I could finish this book in the next, you know, 6 months or whatever it might be. So for a first novel, do some planning, please.
Brilliant advice. Thank you very much, Stephen. It's been a wonderful chat with you, and I've learned so much. And yes. I'm sure hopefully everyone at home has learned something new too. So thank you again.
You're welcome. You're welcome, man. Cheers.
Where's the best place to find out more about you?
Go on my website, stephen-arian.com. Find me on Twitter, @StevArian, on Instagram. Look me up on YouTube. My writing channel there has got like over 100 videos of interviews with authors talking about how they broke in, their books, their writing process, writing advice videos, commentaries on things. Check out that as well. And I post a new video every week. Nice. So yeah, there's a bunch of new ones coming up soon.
Okay, that's a big commitment as well.
It's another kind of avenue to, for me, express some things I want to talk about and write about that I don't have time. And doing it in front of a camera is a lot easier than writing it sometimes.
Yeah, I know. I tell you what, video, everyone loves it at the moment. Go and check it out. I've been watching a good few videos, learning loads. So please do. I'll put the links for everything in the description. And Stephen, thank you once again. And hopefully we'll have a chance to chat again soon.
Cheers, Richie.
I'd like to say a massive thank you to Stephen once again for giving up time out of his busy day to chat with me about the writing process. I learned so, so much, and it's always so helpful to learn from authors who are much more experienced than you, who've seen it and done it, and above all, are open and honest about their experiences. So I genuinely hope you've learned something new today. If you have enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe or follow the show so you don't miss any more episodes. We've got some fantastic interviews lined up with more top fantasy authors. If you really have enjoyed today's episode, a quick rating on the Spotify mobile app goes a long, long way. And a share on social media or with anyone you think may be interested. Again, that helps us massively. So thank you very much if you do that for us. If you'd like to join our writing group and learn more about writing fantasy, then head over to our Patreon page. The link for that is in the description. You can gain access to tips, guides, writing classes, books, and much, much more. So, well worth checking out. And that is pretty much all for today. Thank you very much for listening. Genuinely hoped you enjoyed that interview with Stephen. I certainly did. And I hope it's given you a bit of inspiration, a bit of fuel to go off and carry on writing your own stories. So we'll be back on the 28th of January. And until then, keep on scribbling.